This episode is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. At Lockheed Martin, veterans are at the center of everything they do. In fact, one in five of their employees has served in uniform. Lockheed Martin is proud to help men and women like you successfully transition into civilian careers. Join Lockheed Martin and you will find opportunities to take on the same kind of long-term, challenging assignments you tackled while in the military. Whether you're on active duty, transitioning, or already embarking on your civilian career, Lockheed Martin's Military Connect is your online community for professional support. You can find out more at lockheedmartin.bravenew.com. That's lockheedmartin.bravenew.com. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. Beyond the Uniform is committed to helping military veterans succeed in their civilian career. In order to further our mission, we're launching a 2018 pledge drive. But rather than asking for donations, we're asking for reviews. If you have benefited from this show, please pay it forward by leaving us a positive review on Apple Podcast. There's a link in every episode's show notes, or just Google Apple Podcasts Beyond the Uniform, and it's the number one link. Our goal between now and December 31st is to get to 150 reviews. As a way of saying thank you, we're going to pick our favorite review and send you a free copy of every Beyond the Uniform publication. That's Veterans in Consulting and Veterans at Goldman Sachs, two softcover books, as well as printouts of our five ebooks. More importantly, your review will help us get this show in front of more members of the armed forces and military veterans. Thanks and enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help military veterans navigate their civilian career. Today's episode number 216 with Kimberly Young.
And I remember that time, the first time we went over to Herat, I remember the saffron coming into the room and you could smell it and it was so amazing. And when you saw it, it was in a cardboard box wrapped in string. So it's a problem of marketing and also like packaging, right? Because this is some of the best saffron in the world. You know, Michelin star restaurants and James Beard award-winning chefs love Afghan saffron, you know, from us because it's such high quality, but yet it's in a cardboard box wrapped in string. So, I mean, if you think about how businesses can create value, that is definitely one huge way. And it's a very practical way.
Today's guest was introduced to me by Kill Anderson from episode number 182 at the Pat Tillman Foundation, who described Kim as someone who moves a mile a minute. That may be an understatement. Kim went from the Army to Harvard Business School, where she started Rumi Spice, a for-profit company that employs over 2,000 women in Afghanistan. She raised over $500,000 in 24 hours, appeared on the TV show The Shark Tank, where she raised funds from Mark Cuban himself. She is now at MIT getting another advanced degree and focusing on the space industry. She asks herself frequently about if she is operating at 100% happiness, and if she's not, she finds a way to get there. There is something for everyone in this episode. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io in the show notes for this episode, you'll find links to everything we discuss. You'll also find information about our coaching program, where you can get subsidized coaching with one-on-one professional coaches to help you in your career and to achieve your peak potential. You'll also find over 215 other episodes just like this. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Kim. Well, joining me today from Boston, Massachusetts is Kimberly Young. Kim, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks, Justin. So happy to be here.
And do you prefer Kim or Kimberly?
Kim's fine.
Kim, great. Well, for listeners, I want to give a quick background on Kim. She's got a very impressive background. Special thanks to Kill Anderson, episode number 182. He introduced me to Kim. She's a Tillman scholar, among other things. But Kim is currently a graduate student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And she also serves as the vice president of the board of directors of Bunker Labs. She started out at West Point, after which she served as an officer in the Army for 5 years, most recently as a brigade construction officer. After her military service, she earned her MBA from Harvard Business School and then started Rumi Spice,
a for-profit social enterprise that imports saffron from Afghan farmers and cooperatives. So Kim, maybe to start things off, how did you decide to separate from the army?
While I was in the army, I learned a lot. I got to get stationed in Germany and got a chance to lead troops. And I left because there was something else I wanted to do, which was to learn the skills and to continue on what it's like to be a leader, which in my mind, a business school really does. Because what you learn to do is to learn to mobilize resources and people to get a mission done. So I left the army to continue on with the same mission, is to figure out how to do that.
And how did you decide between going directly into the workforce or starting a company versus going to business school first?
I mean, I wish I could have a better answer for you. I definitely got advice from a bunch of people to either way, right? Like A, go to business school, or B, go work out into the workforce. And I think I just didn't know. And so I remember I did actually apply to a couple places, and I also applied to business school, and I didn't necessarily close any doors immediately at that point. But once I got into Harvard Business School, it was kind of a no-brainer that I should go there.
And I was curious, like, I want to talk about Roomy Spice, but I'm wondering, was that an idea you had while on active duty? Did that occur at business school? I'd love to learn more about the origin.
Roomy Spice came about when we were at business school, and I had remembered some of my experiences while I was in the Army. Basically, like, you know, a lot of the stuff we did, I'm very proud of. But it seemed to be addressing an effect rather than the problem. So it's like putting on Band-Aids over something that's, the underlying problem is lack of economic opportunity. And my other co-founders felt the same way. So we had a couple of former military officers who had all served in Afghanistan. And we all felt kind of similarly about the work that we did in Afghanistan versus what can be done or what should be done. And we all came together and decided to start a small business opening up markets for Afghan farmers. So these farmers are not recipients of charity. They are our business partners. They are very much part of our supply chain. They have a stake at how well we do. We have a stake at how well they do, you know, basically how well they grow their saffron and how well that we sell and market their saffron. And it goes way beyond that because we're very much tied in with the processing as well. So Roomy Spice has three processing centers in Afghanistan. And we actually directly hire these Afghan women, 2,000 of them actually this past harvest. And these farmers work with us, you know, with marketing, because they know that the better job that we do in that, the more saffron that we can process with them.
I think that's really incredible. And one thing I wanted to ask about, because I know a lot of listeners are aspiring entrepreneurs. How did you and your co-founders approach that initial decision of whether or not to have this be for-profit or non-profit?
That question is definitely something that we've struggled with for a while in the beginning, and there are pros and cons, right? So at the end of the day, both a non-profit and a for-profit are businesses, so they have a P&L, whether or not you keep track of it. So with a for-profit, all the stakeholders involved have a monetary value attached to what they contribute and also what they receive. In a nonprofit, it's a little bit different because the people who are donating the money are not necessarily people who are the recipients of the value that's supposed to be created by the nonprofit. So immediately there's a dissonance between, it's actually called an agency problem. It ends up being an accountability problem. So we really struggled with this, and looking kind of at our experiences in Afghanistan with the same agency problem with regards to massive government budgets and USAID and other things, we wanted to try a different approach, which is a for-profit enterprise. So again, I mentioned that these farmers are not recipients of charity. They very much have an economic stake in what we're doing. And when everyone has that economic stake, it actually ends up becoming very fair. And during the course of us running this business for 4 years, we discovered that there's a lot of other businesses out there who are for-profit, who are doing great things for the world and serving up the needs of many, many people. So people tend to wrongly equate nonprofit with good and for-profit with bad. And that is completely not the case. And if anything, I could make a strong argument for the other way around.
And this, I'm assuming that you and your co-founders, you're not only going to classes at Harvard Business School, but you're launching this company. What was that like balancing both of those simultaneously?
It was tough. I lived with Emily Miller at the time, and she's another one of the co-founders. So we were attending classes, and then in the evenings, we would be working furiously in the business, and our living room was just filled up to the top, to the ceiling, with all these boxes and equipment and things that we were shipping out and packaging and everything. So we didn't really have a life for about a year, including the summer. So that was tough, for sure, but what better way to learn business than by doing it?
Yeah, I always wish that while I was at business school, I had an idea, even if it wasn't something I was going to pursue, because I just feel like I imagine or maybe romanticize it would force me to extract more value from a class, because rather than just having it be what for me felt like more of a theoretical exercise, every class could have some practical use, which is how can I apply this to this idea? So I'm jealous of that. I think that's great that you had that while in school.
Thanks.
What was the starting point like? Were you and your co-founders flying back to Afghanistan and meeting with the women that you now work with, or how did you start to get things to become a real company?
In February or March of 2014, I was in entrepreneurship class, and it occurred to me, because at that time, Harvard was asking everybody, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? And we were supposed to do like a little write-up or essay on it. And I really got to thinking about that question because, you know, like when you make big decisions about what you do to spend your time every day, you know, you don't have very much time left and it's always ticking down. You know, money is going to decrease and increase at whatever. But the way that you spend your time is always decreasing. So I thought to myself, I've always wanted to start a business in Afghanistan and I've wanted to help these Afghan women. I thought of it that way at first. So how can I do that? And I'm in a great position to do that because A, I'm going to graduate from Harvard Business School and I'm going to be covered. You know, if anything bad happens, I'm still going to have a degree from there. So that was one thing, but that could really apply to a lot of things, right? Not just Harvard Business School. Depending on what your bottom net is for yourself. And then I wasn't married. I'm not married now either. And I don't have kids. And I was happy like eating ramen and sleeping on couches if I really had to. So for me, it wasn't that much of a leap to start a business and to really just go for it. So I bought myself a ticket to Afghanistan and I got my entrepreneurship professor to come with me. And we met up with Keith, who was deployed at the time in the Wardak province. Actually, it was in Kabul that we met, but we met with a farmer who was from Wardak in Kabul. And then we also went to the western part of Afghanistan. And there we met with 11 other farmers. And I remember just traveling around as a civilian, wearing a hijab, not having, you know, a bunch of weapons or forest protection with us. And it was so much more refreshing and free, and I felt like a normal person. And these farmers also probably appreciated that too. At first, these farmers wouldn't shake my hand because it's not part of their custom to touch another woman who's not part of their family. But, you know, a year later, they were taking selfies with me and shaking my hand because, you know, they're part of this business and they know what needs to happen to basically sell their saffron bulbs. And I remember that time, the first time we went over to Herat, I remember the saffron coming into the room and you could smell it and it was so amazing. And when you saw it, it was in a cardboard box wrapped in string. So it's a problem of marketing and also like packaging, right? Because this is some of the best saffron in the world. You know, Michelin star restaurants and James Beard award-winning chefs love Afghan saffron, you know, from us because it's such high quality. but yet it's in a cardboard box wrapped in string. So, I mean, if you think about how businesses can create value, that is definitely one huge way. And it's a very practical way that I think, you know, what we did in the military and USAID or government has kind of overlooked, you know, that's at the end of the day, like what's going to really help change hearts and minds is building the small businesses through like selling, marketing and sales. Other stuff is kind of tangential to that. They all lead to marketing and sales. Farmers want money. That's it. People want to feed their families.
I love that, and I respect. I just, there's something about that mission where it's like the thought of those farmers earning this and being a partner in this that seems to me so empowering versus like the approach of giving them money. Or I've always been a fan of like microloans and things like that. So I love this sense that they are legitimate partners with you. And I can imagine that psychologically for them, that's very empowering rather than just being recipients of charity or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
What were the, I want to talk about other things that you've been up to, but you were with Rumi Spice for over 4 years. What was that like? And I'm particularly thinking of people listening who are on active duty who want to be an entrepreneur, and maybe most of their context for entrepreneurship is popular media or TV shows or movies. I'd love for them to get a sense from you of what the real day in, day out experience was like, both the good and the bad.
I think that I had my first entrepreneurship training when I was still in the Army and I was a brigade construction officer. So I had a small budget and I was organizing these basically construction projects across Fort Leonard Wood. And you wouldn't think that was entrepreneurial, but like more like bureaucratic. But that's actually like, you know, entrepreneurs will like, they go through the bureaucracy. They go through like people and resources. They like are, they know how to talk to people and basically get what you need, and get not in a like necessarily heavy-handed way, but no matter what approach you take and you have a bunch of, you know, tools in your toolbox for how to deal with people, you're able to influence people to give you the time, resources, and talent that they have that you don't have or that you need at that time. So at Fort Leonard Wood, I remember like having to, it was like corralling cats a little bit because I was talking with DPW and also talking with various units who had like pots of like gravel or different pieces of equipment here and there, and cobbling them together and making sure that they got something out of it from the other people. And then we were able to build all these construction projects, but it couldn't have been done by like a single unit. Like I had to go around and like basically make deals with people based on resources from other people I'd been talking with. And I think anyone can do that. And it's just, it's hustle and it's diligence and it's people skills. There's so many good and bad things. It's like a huge roller coaster. I remember when at Rumi Spice, we were kind of balancing between a couple of, this was after Shark Tank, and we were trying to close the deal with Mark Cuban, but we also had our other investors who wanted to also be part of it and were not necessarily too happy with what we had struck with Mark Cuban, and we weren't necessarily happy either. And then we needed money at the same time because the harvest was coming up, so we needed about $200,000 at the time. And we got a loan from the VEDC. And then about a week after we were supposed to get the money, we were kind of like, not panicking, but like, where's this money? Because we needed to send it over to Afghanistan and start using it. I got a call from the VEDC saying, oh, sorry, like, we can't support you on this loan for like one various reason or the other. And it was like, what? And our business was going to close. And I remember I was in Turkey at the time because we were interfacing with another supplier. And Emily and I pulled some all-nighters, made a lot of calls. And at the end of the day, like, VEDC got sick enough because we made some calls And then they offered us another loan because they knew that we needed, because they were trying to, they were making us go to some of these events, like, oh, look how we're helping veterans and helping women entrepreneurs. So we went because they were about to give us that loan, and then all of a sudden they pulled it for no reason, like because somebody, a couple of people on their board resigned or something like that, like nothing to do with us. So anyway, these things happen, and you have to be super scrappy. And we ended up getting, we raised, how much did we raise? Like 415 or something like that, a little over $500,000 in less than 24 hours because this happened. And we made calls to the people who were basically came to our aid. So sometimes that happens. Sometimes you get people who come to your aid. Sometimes like you're stuck in a hard place and you end up having to not pay payroll. It sucks. So it's good and bad. It's a roller coaster up and down.
What was the, how did the Shark Tank experience come about? And in the episode, I'll put a link in the show notes for listeners. Mark Cuban offered you $250,000. You had originally asked for $250,000 for five. I understand it would be 5% of the company, and he wanted 15%. And so I'm curious kind of what led to Shark Tank, what that experience was like, but also what it was like in that moment of, because he I think it said like, hey, no room for negotiation on this. This is it. And just kind of how that felt and how you approached that on the spot decision.
Yeah, Mark Cuban said there was no negotiation. I will caveat everything by saying that all reality TV has been cut in many different places and then rearranged. So what is shown on the show for what happens is actually kind of very far sometimes from what actually has happened. And that's just the way it is. Because the whole purpose of Shark Tank is to get viewers and to get advertising to pay for their spots. So this is entertainment. So either way, what this, you know, you got to think about what's in it for Rolling Spice. A, we get to be in front of a couple of VCs or angel investors, really, that's what they are, who can potentially invest in the business, but also who bring their skills and their networks and their resources to the table. So it's not just their money, it's their network and resources. But I also will say it's not their fame either, because tell me exactly what fame translates into for dollar value or for exactly how it's going to specifically help out your product and your industry. So that's kind of the thinking, right? And the second thing that's good for Rolling Spice is that we get in front of 8 million viewers and there's reruns. So those people visit our website and then they buy our Saffron and our Saffron products. And that's fantastic. And there's also an added benefit of if you're talking with any other corporates, you know, if you like, if you're trying to make deals with, let's say, like Whole Foods, or you're trying to get them to buy our Saffron, they're going to know that you were on Shark Tank, and that's huge. And that sometimes tips their decision making towards you sometimes. So Shark Tank, at the end of the day, is not so much about perhaps getting at the actual investment, because those investment terms are not that friendly. And you can get money from elsewhere. The question is, are these sharks going to be actually good value to you, those specific sharks? Like, who else is in their portfolio? Are they also, do they also support CPG food companies? Do they have any expertise in selling Saffron to high-end markets and online channels? Or Dean and DeLucas of the world? Like, those are the questions that you ask. But you should ask those questions for anything that you do, whether you're hiring a contractor to do digital marketing for you. Like, are they really great? What does their portfolio look like? Who else is using them? You know, all that stuff. Anyway, Shark Tank was great.
I always think of, so one of our investors for Storybox is Google's chairman, Eric Schmidt. And I think in terms of like, okay, well, we got money from him. We got the credibility that you alluded to, where it's like, okay, we can use that in meetings and it makes us seem more credible. But, you know, I met with Eric once and for minutes. You know, it wasn't like I was getting any advice from him. Right. It wasn't like I was getting his perspective. And I was curious what your experience was with my assumption when I watched the show is that, you know, Mark maybe will respond to an email once in the life of the company, but I can't imagine any of them being very involved. And I'm curious what your experience was like in directly interacting with him or getting his advice.
I think Mark has a couple hundred companies in his portfolio, and they range in industry from everything from CPG to like a sausage mail order company to online beer or something like that. I don't know. But basically he's got a whole team who's responsible for managing his investments. So that's great, but you don't actually have direct access to Mark Cuban. You know what you do? Because you're able to email him, and we did that, and he would respond within, I would say, 3 hours. I feel like he's always on his phone. So that's good. And he's very cut and dry, so he doesn't want any fluff, and you need to be very direct with him, and he'll be very direct with you. I appreciate that. That's more of how I operate. So I understand, because he's got, like, no time, right? Otherwise, I mean, I don't know, like, you would want to have some sort of advice, or you could just tell him what you want him to do, and he'll tell you if he'll do it or not. Like, it would be great to have him show up to an event or something like that. Like, people would love to meet Mark Cuban, and the people who I want him to meet would be like my potential buyers from Whole Foods or something, right? That's how I would try to cobble that and hustle. But there's only so much he'll do.
That makes sense. I'm just thinking when you're a billionaire, a $250,000 investment's the equivalent of me giving someone a penny or two. So it's like, you have to wonder.
Exactly.
I also wanted to ask so Rumi Spice is a B corporation. I don't actually think I've had someone on the show who is a B corp, and I'm just curious, could you just give the brief explanation to listeners of what a B corporation is and any thoughts on if they should go through that process or what that process was like?
B Corp is a community of for-profit enterprises who have a social mission or who do good in the world. Like anything, right? You have to approach things with skepticism and think about what do they stand for? What do they benefit from? What does the benefit group benefit from? And they're great because they really have a lot of resources and people and information about how to operate a successful bottom line company that also has these, I wouldn't say constraints, because they wouldn't see it necessarily as constraints of how they operate. And these constraints are basically like social and environmental factors that are positive. You have to pay for it, you know, at least for the questionnaire part of it. And then they come out and they look at your company and interview. And then you get this stamp and that you're able to put on your packaging that says B Corp. And then you get invited to the B Corp conferences and get to meet with other people. So what does that mean? You get to meet with other people and talk with them about their strategies. About what? I don't know. and also potentially some of your future buyers, like, you know, let's say the Whole Foods buyer, again, that's just my general term for a buyer. They might look more favorably upon you if you were B Corp certified. So that's good. That's how I would think of a B Corp certification. Same thing with fair trade certified, because that one's expensive and you get that stamp that you're able to like put on your packaging, and then you can tell buyers that you're fair trade certified because they care, because their consumers care. But I already know I'm fair trade certified, or I already know I'm fair trade, you know, like we do what we do. I don't do that. You know what I mean? I don't know how to quit if I'm
yep.
quite like,
nope, that makes sense.
Communicating
yep.
what I'm saying.
Yep. No,
it's
that
marketing is what it is.
That's like the theme of the experience is it all boils down to marketing. It all boils down to packaging. So after over 4 years at Rumi Spice running the company, what led you to move on?
at any stage, you know that at some point you are not the best person for the job, and it's time to hand the reins over to someone else who can do a better job and who's potentially more suited for that stage. And I'm very much a early entrepreneur, early in the stage of a business where there's nothing and I get it from zero to one. And I could potentially do more than that, but I think I'm best suited for zero to one. And our other co-founder, Keith, has really great analytical and organizational leadership skills. And he wanted to take over the business. And so he took over in about last year, I think, March or April of 2018. So actually this year. And I wanted to move on because I'm still, the way that I make decisions in life, these big decisions, is like, am I operating at 100% happiness? And I think people would probably say, like, why would you ever be at 100%? But I would say I'm absolutely at 100%. Like, I'm at MIT and I am surrounded by, like, you know, nanorobots and all sorts of, like, amazing, like, medical technologies and all this, like, math on the board. And I'm spending over 30 hours per week on problem sets and not sleeping very much and surrounded by these amazing, smart, intelligent, and nuanced people. I would be nowhere else. So I'm really operating with 100% happiness here. And I don't think that anybody should be operating anything below 80%.
So, I love it. I love it.
But the people who can say that are the ones who are A, financially stable, which is not always the case for everybody, B, who don't have families and children and responsibilities in being a husband or wife and that kind of stuff. I don't have any of that. I'm living currently in a dorm room, and I can live off of basically almost nothing, and I don't have a family. I mean, like, I don't have kids of my own. I don't have a boyfriend or a husband. And this is how I want to operate right now.
That's awesome.
So I'm at that life stage.
What did lead you? I have questions about the in between time, but it was surprising to me that you went back to school. And I think it's also so awesome because it's very evident how energized you are and how much you're enjoying that environment. But where did that decision come from? Like, how did you go from CEO of this company and say, you know what, I want to go back and get even more education?
Well, I don't think of it as education. I've always wanted to go back into engineering, and my dream is to work in the space industry. I want to see humankind in space. And for me, I don't understand why anyone else would not want to be part of this, right? So, like, that's how strongly I feel about this. Like, you know, you go outside at night and you look 360 degrees in every direction, and then 180 degrees, right, up and down. And there are billion stars with potential life out there and all these other planets and solar systems and nebulas. And we're right in the beginning part of that. We're sending Mars rovers out and exploring the seas of Europa. And I want to be part of that. And so that's why I'm going back to MIT for mechanical engineering, because this is going to propel me towards that dream of working in this industry.
I love it. We could do a whole nother interview about, I love science fiction. I love space. I love all of that. So it's so energizing to hear you say that. And I agree that I think the most exciting industries right now are that it feels like at times the only, and I've spent 10 years plus in startups, but like the only true startup feeling is like these people who are saying we want to go to another planet. That's like it, that yes. To me has the same resonant feeling that it must have felt like, you know, when Steve Jobs was creating computers and they were like democratizing the access to information and to computing power. And like that at the time must have felt like game changing and world changing. And then now sometimes I get cynical because it's like, well, now I'm working on technology to help people sell more stuff online. It's just not, it doesn't have that same life-changing experience. But then you talk about the long-time survival of a species being, you know, almost predicated on having not all of our eggs in one basket on one planet and really exploring and getting out there. So there's so many things about what you're saying that are exciting for me to hear.
Awesome. Yeah, we should definitely talk more about this stuff.
What about, when Patrick Kill Anderson introduced us. He had told me, you know, Kimberly is a mile a minute. She's just such an impressive human being. And he said, one of the things he said that I wanted to ask about, he said, yeah, she just wrapped up a self-reliant leadership crucible in Alaska. And I kind of wanted to ask about that and what that experience was like, but just kind of also what you got up to in between coming out of 4 years at Rumi Spice and then starting at MIT.
The trip with Self-Reliant Leadership to Alaska was absolutely amazing. And I got to meet so many amazing people who are at various stages in their transition from becoming being military to civilian. So we had a couple of special forces guys who had been in, who sergeant major for 20 plus years, or you know, someone who was working for Google who just transitioned like less than a year ago and is working as a programmer. And he used to be an infantry officer. So you get to hear so many different perspectives, and we all learn from each other. And we were hiking a glacier, you know, and sleeping on the glacier for like a couple of nights and freezing our butts off and conquering these mountains together and backpacking. And you couldn't have asked for like a better trip with the best people that I could ever hope to be with. And so to be a part of this experience, a part of these other veterans, transition time to have them open up and share and then share of my own was very eye-opening. You know, we all became very very open. Brene Brown, what did she talk about again? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, vulnerability. And
vulnerability, yeah.
Yep.
So we're all very vulnerable. So I highly recommend these sorts of trips. I think Outward Bound is very similar things.
And I'm assuming the I'm reading into this that part of the motivation was life experience, but part of the motivation was I'm guessing you have aspirations to be an astronaut, and this is training that would prepare you for that. Is that right?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know if I actually will ever become an astronaut. I'm sure that if the job stuff came out for applications, I would absolutely apply. But I'm happy like going anywhere in the space industry. But if I could be an astronaut, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
That's awesome. I had a couple, I know we're running low on time here, but just a couple questions that were still on my mind. One is your thoughts on the MBA as it relates to entrepreneurship and, whether you would advise that to listeners. And then a second piece of that is just kind of any other advice that you would have to someone listening who aspires to start their own company.
I'm a huge fan of the MBA. I think it was hugely valuable. People would argue you don't need it. Yeah, you don't need it. You can learn accounting, finance, and marketing, whatever, elsewhere. So you can have those skills, and those are absolutely basic necessary skills that you need before you start a business. So taking like accounting, finance, et cetera, is you got to do that. The other thing that getting an MBA does is opens you up to a great network. So when we started Rumi Spice, if it wasn't for the Harvard network, we wouldn't have been able to meet our farmers, actually. Those were not farmers I met when I was deployed. We met them because one of my classmates' uncles was a head contractor engineer for Sheridan Associates, who was hired by Asian Development Bank to build irrigation systems for these farmers in Herat. That's how we met our first farmers, through HBS. Getting an MBA, I mentioned like accounting, finance is like basic skills, but the larger picture for all that is like tools for how to lead people, which means, specifically for a business, how to get those resources and mobilize people and inspire them and organize your effort so that people are all moving in the same direction. And that's how you grow.
And one of the things, the other things I wanted to ask was just how you think about taking risks, managing risks, exploring the unknown. You had said earlier, and I think this is very valid, in some ways, going to Harvard Business School was a huge risk mitigation, and that you know, at the very least, you could always fall back on that degree. You were never going to be unemployed. You'd always have some source of income or ability to earn money. But it seems like one of the hallmarks of your story is really, you know, I mean, I think it's probably epitomized by that, am I operating at 100% happiness? Just, it seems like you are a person who lives at their edge and finds that area of discomfort and pushes right up to it and takes risks and takes chances and really swings to knock it out of the park and really swings for the fences. And so I'm curious if you have any thoughts or advice on that whole area of managing risk and exploring the unknown.
That's a great question. I don't think you're necessarily born with that. So if you cultivate that, you know, you can become more like that. I don't know if it's for everybody, right? Because I would probably start to change when I have a family and my priorities will be different. The way that I think about things is like, you know, I think people don't accurately make that calculation of how they spend their time. And if someone were to ask me, if you died tomorrow, would you have done everything that you've done? I said, absolutely yes. I'm happy. I'm happy if I die tomorrow. I've lived my life absolutely to the fullest. I carpe diem the crap out of my life right now. And I don't know why people don't spend their time that way. They make choices based on what's kind of like instantly in front of them when they don't realize that the entire world is in front of them. And if they had some gumption and dedication and no embarrassment to fail, that they would go out there and then continue. Like, it's like woodpecker, like being a woodpecker. You see things that you like and you go after it. And like, you don't always get it. And it's fine. Like, there's so many things that I didn't get in my whole life. And people like maybe look at my resume or whatever and think, oh, everything's come easily to her. No, not at all. Like, not even close. Like, I failed so many times and been extremely embarrassed. And like, I'm over that stuff. I'm never embarrassed really anymore. I always give things my best shot and try to support people, other people on the way. And we're all in this together. You know, we're all trying to just live life. So why not live life to the fullest and realize that there are so many more opportunities in front of you that you can take. And you might not actually succeed in taking them, but you continue to try.
I love that. And I love that thought of when you said, you know, people kind of look at what's immediately in front of them and then like, but the whole world is there. I love extending that even further when I think of you, and it's like, oh, it's in your case, it's like looking around and realizing like, oh, the stars are actually in the playing field now. That's actually a possibility. So I'm going to go after that. I think that's just a cool way of seeing in action this thought of, really taking a step back and seeing all the possibilities available and realizing that there's more possibilities than one might initially think. Well, I always like to keep, I always like to keep the last question open-ended, and you know, I appreciate your joining me today, and I appreciate all the things we've talked about with exploration and entrepreneurship and business school and all of these different aspects. But I'm sure there's things that I didn't ask about that that are maybe on your mind. And so I'd love to just kind of ask you, what have we not covered that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up?
I'm just really, I feel very blessed and fortunate to be on this podcast with you, Justin, because you're kind of a, you know, I think we share a lot of the same attitudes about life, and you go out there and you go for it, and you're kind of a mover and shaker. You are a mover and shaker, and I really admire a lot of your entrepreneurial success and the ways that you've contributed and given back also in this podcast. So I just want to say thank you, and that I feel very happy to be connected with you, and I hope that people listening on this podcast like realize like how amazing you are.
Thank you. That's that means a lot. I appreciate that. I know why Patrick connected us. I think he, but I feel this sense of gratitude for having you on the show as well. Like you just have an incredible background, but I think more than the background, I appreciate and I hope listeners are getting that same sense of just the kind of like the electrifying energy of seeing someone who's playing, like the phrase I love, and maybe it's overused, but that phrase of playing full out and not holding back. And it's on my mind. There's a movie I'm seeing this weekend called Free Solo, but it's about Alex Honnold, who did the free climb of El Capitan. And it's just this sense of
Ooh.
awe of someone who is knows what their purpose is in life and pursues it without fear or pursues it with courage at the very least. And I put you in that
Right.
category of someone who is just really living at their edge. And I think that's inspiring for me, and I think that's inspiring for the listeners. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Justin. It's been such a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Uniform. There are over 200 free episodes at beyondtheuniform.io. They're classified by the industry of focus, the functional role the person plays, and more. Beyond the Uniform is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our director of outreach, responsible for sponsorship and guest episodes, is Steve Bain. Our editor, responsible for the show notes and text transcripts for all episodes, is Kathleen Dillon. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge. If you are enjoying Beyond the Uniform, you can help us out by telling your veterans and friends in the military about this free resource. There is more information on the website about how you can sponsor an episode or donate to our program to help us grow the work that we're doing. Be sure to check out the coaching section of beyondtheuniform.io, where you can be paired with professional, subsidized coaches to help you figure out your next career move. You can sign up for our newsletter to be up to date on the latest happenings at Beyond the Uniform. And in each show notes section, there is a link to audible.com, which is providing a free audiobook of your choice to Beyond the Uniform listeners. You get a free book of your choosing, and Beyond the Uniform gets $15 to subsidize the cost of the show, regardless of whether you continue with audible.com or not. Check that out and more in the show notes for this episode. Keep the feedback coming. Let me know what resources would help you in your career, and we'll do our best to make that happen. Take care, be safe, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career.